Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Report podcast. My special guest today is Professor of History at Western Connecticut State University, Dr. Kevin Gutzman. He's the author of many books on American history, most notably his recent work, James Madison and the Making of America, which is available at many fine bookstores. He's also the creator of Liberty Classroom at libertyclassroom.com. Dr. Gutzman, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Dr. Gutzman, it's an honor to have you on my show today. I've read many of your books. I'm a great fan of yours. I've invited you on my show today because I think my listeners would sincerely appreciate your insight into current events from a libertarian historian's perspective. Now, today in the news, the president called for a summit to combat violent extremism. He says that these terrorists, he's referring to ISIS, are desperate for legitimacy and that all of us have a responsibility to refute the notion that groups like ISIS somehow represent Islam. Obama says that that is a falsehood. Kevin, do you believe that ISIS represents Islam?
Well, obviously it's not a mainstream current in Islam, but it is a very broadly appealing element of Islam. And so I think in the same way as a minor Christian group could be said to be Christian, a minor Islamic group with growing significance can be, and I think has to be, called Islamic.
I would agree. The State Department said that we'll never win a shooting war with ISIS terrorists. What is your response to that kind of a statement?
Well, of course, my first response to the phenomenon of ISIS is to say that it's really not America's problem. Mm-hmm. Insofar as there might be an ISIS attack upon the United States, I think it's appropriate for the American government to take reprisals, but as far as clearing ISIS out from northern Iraq and eastern Syria, that seems to me to be a problem for Arab Muslims in the Middle East, not for the U.S. government.
So just from a psychological perspective of our own U.S. government, what was your reaction when you heard that the State Department claimed that the problem with ISIS is that these people just need jobs?
Well, I think it demonstrates significant ignorance of the backgrounds of a lot of people who are prominent not only in ISIS but in Al-Qaeda. Not only was Al-Qaeda founded by people who were extremely wealthy, like bin Laden, very, very wealthy people, but the majority of the 9/11 hijackers were people with college degrees, people from middle and upper middle class backgrounds. The same is true of many of the people who are involved in ISIS. So the other thing is, I don't know exactly what the point of making this kind of a claim is anyway. All I can infer from it is that there's going to be some attempt down the road to persuade Americans that we ought to have public welfare programs funded by the American taxpayer for unhappy Middle Eastern Arab Muslims.
All right. Do you believe that ISIS is a real threat to the people of the United States now or in the future?
Well, in what sense? I suppose from time to time, assuming that ISIS continues to dominate a large area in Iraq and Syria, it might be able to carry off terrorist attacks on Americans in the United States and abroad. So in that sense, I suppose one could say it would be preferable that ISIS didn't exist. On the other hand, certainly not an existential threat. I think that's obvious. I don't anticipate anything significant happening to me, not only to me, but to people in my state as a result of ISIS activities. So,
what about the citizens of the state of New York, perhaps in New York City and Washington D.C., where I actually live, and I don't walk around afraid of terrorism, but I do live in a heightened security area. So what about people like us that's part of this union?
Well, I'm about 50 miles from Ground Zero as I speak. And as I said, I do guess that ISIS could eventually carry off terrorist attack in America. If it did so, New York would be a prime target. But what is one to conclude from that? It's not possible to eliminate the possibility of terrorist attacks in New York City. So the problem we have is, I think, that in the post-Cold War age, when really we are safer than we have been since before World War II, the federal government still has the imperative to seek out dangers and then respond to them in the old-fashioned way. I don't think there's really much weighing of costs against benefits here. Mm-hmm. So do I say that we're perfectly safe from ISIS? Well, I suppose not, but I'm sure I'm more in danger when I go out and drive my car this afternoon than I am through the balance of my life from ISIS.
Okay, so let's get to your area of expertise. Thomas Jefferson is often looked to as a hero of modern classical liberals such as yourself and myself, and yet when it came to fighting the ISIS of his day, the Barbary pirates, you know, he waged war against them, and he did so unilaterally. I guess my question is does that make him a hypocrite, or does that make the modern libertarians perhaps a bit too pacifist when it comes to those kinds of threats?
Well, I think the word libertarian applies to various groups of people with various shades of belief. And, of course, there is a substantial, noisy contingent of anarchists who are going to say that any government activity is lamentable and should be criticized. And leaving them aside, what Jefferson, of course, did was to get Congress to authorize him to use the military in protection of American ships in the Mediterranean, which were being regularly attacked by, it wasn't actually something like ISIS, it was North African Muslim states. And so ultimately American naval personnel put an end to that threat. It seems to me that that's precisely the kind of response that we had to the Afghan Taliban after 9/11. I think there was nothing inappropriate about that, except that in the wake of taking down the Taliban, then, as I mentioned before, we have mission creep as the guiding principle of the U.S. government. And so from taking down the Taliban, we ended up with a decade-long mission of remaking Afghanistan in our own image, which any, pardon my language, damn fool could see was not going to be successful. So again, the rhetoric that we've heard from the State Department about ISIS does sound as if this impulse of nation building underlies it, and that's really problematic. But Jefferson's, Jefferson's initiative was not to remake the North African states into peaceful, democratic, regular members of the international community. Instead, he just inflicted military punishment on them and made them stop, which, again, I think is perfectly appropriate.
Yeah, so that was going to be my next question. I mean, so, you know, some historians have argued that the Barbary Wars were really about an American expansion of free trade and not the kind of holy war conflicts that we see today. My next question was going to be, how do you think that Mr. Jefferson would respond to ISIS today if he were president?
Well, two things. One, they wouldn't have been attacking American shipping if American shipping had been manned by Muslim sailors. So to that extent, they were following the Islamic teachings about what proper behavior toward infidels is. I don't think there's anybody among the early high officials of the United States government who wouldn't have said that the proper response to ISIS was, in case they attacked us, to attack them. That you know, reprisal, in other words. But they don't presently, as far as I can see, constitute a threat to the United States. So we've had, of course, the usual suspects calling for war on ISIS, and there's been a lot of criticism of President Obama for quote-unquote leading from behind, which as far as I can tell means not launching yet another war in Iraq. It seems to me that what he's doing is perfectly consistent with what Jefferson did. And again, Jefferson didn't raise an army and go conquer Tunisia. That was...
He let his predecessor, John Adams, raise that army, and which he put to good use.
Well, it wasn't the army, it was the Navy.
Well, and the Marines.
Right, but what they did was destroy the same military structure that was being used to attack American shipping. So my point was they didn't occupy North African states. They didn't try to remake their governments. They didn't try to force them to behave in international affairs as the United States was going to behave. They just made clear that future such behavior against the United States would lead to further reprisals, and that was perfectly adequate. I mean, I think that's what we should have done in Afghanistan,
well,
too.
Well, you're sort of kind of echoing the foreign policy of the modern objectivists, who are sort of a kill them all, let God sort them out, that we don't believe in, the God we don't believe in, sort them out. But the objectivist idea is, you know, just go in there with overwhelming force, to kill, 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 and get out. No nation building. Is that sort of what you're trying to say in a you know, more perfunctory or just a more articulate way?
Well, my model for this, besides Jefferson, is 19th century Britain. You know, when Britain had problems with subject peoples in the 19th century, they didn't raise a gigantic army and go occupy Sudan for 50 years. What they did was go in and destroy their army and say, do it again, we'll do it again, and go home. That should be America's modus operandi when it comes to foreign countries with whom we don't really need to deal. You know, we don't really have any permanent interest in having any kind of relations with, for example, Syria, which has not really had any regular intercourse with America since the Assad family came to power in 1970. So there's no reason why we need to think that we need to clear out eastern Syria of ISIS.
Would you make that same argument with Germany and Japan after World War II?
Well, Germany and Japan were conquered countries. They were completely leveled. I think it was a different kind of a situation because they had made clear that they were threats to the United States. It was the Japanese military that attacked Hawaii.
There was nation building, of course, after the war, and there was occupation.
Right. I didn't say that occupation was never appropriate. There had to be some kind of government in Germany. Part of the reason for that calculus was that you had the not too secretly hostile Soviet Union immediately to Germany's east at the end of World War II. So immediate evacuation likely would have meant a Soviet sphere of influence all the way to the Rhine, which, again, this is a completely different kind of a scenario from the one we're talking about. Essentially, ISIS is a backwater development in a backward religion among backward people whose affection, let alone intercourse, we don't need.
Right. So I guess my point is that from a philosophical perspective, not a consequentialist one, the the libertarian perspective would be, you know, if you must make war, then perhaps then afterwards there really should be no nation building. And when Ron Paul says no nation building, he means no nation building ever. But you seem to say that in some cases there does make sense if perhaps, you know, there would be a Soviet occupation, or if North Korea perhaps were to try and invade South Korea. There would be a vacuum if the United States were to leave the DMZ, for example. So are you saying that there are some cases where it is appropriate indeed to occupy a country?
Well, certainly, yes.
The nation build.
I think that was appropriate after World War II. I have repeatedly and publicly called for withdrawing American forces from South Korea. I think we should give South Korea, you know, 10 or 15 years notice. And tell the Japanese the same thing. You know, in 15 years from now, we're not going to defend you guys anymore. You need to defend yourselves. But one thing that would likely happen would be an alliance between South Korea and Japan of mutual defense against what? Against China. And America, you know, America's role could be naval. But my point is that, well, I don't think that the knee-jerk, certainly the knee-jerk anarchist response, but I don't think Ron Paul's tendency just to state a blanket rule really works in international affairs. Each case really is sui generis, you know? So,
yes, I mean, I had a conversation with a conservative, a neoconservative once about this, and I said, well, isn't your position inconsistent? And he says, isn't the world inconsistent?
Right.
Yes, it is. In Federalist Number 24, Alexander Hamilton argued that without a federal navy of respectable weight, American merchants and navigators would be stifled and lost. Do you agree with Hamilton, and do you believe we need a strong military to protect American trade overseas?
I'm not sure I ever say this, but yeah, I agree with Hamilton.
I ask the tough questions, Professor, to libertarians. I do this because I think I want our ideas to be sharp. And I want us to be able to win. And in order to do so, we have to be able to face down tough questions, not just from our enemies, but from within. And, you know,
let me elaborate a little bit.
Please do.
Okay. Well, there's, of course, a distinction between saying the United States needs to have a substantial Navy and saying that we have to have a strong military and project our values, influence, I think, ego, all around the world. I would pare down America's military commitments substantially. I mentioned the one in South Korea. I would do the same thing in regard to Okinawa. It's 70 years since that ceremony on the Missouri, and still we have an army on Okinawa. It makes no sense to me. And there are various ways in which America's military footprint in the world could be reduced. But yes, America is a naval power. Essentially, we are a continent, and we need to be in communication with Asia and Europe. So how would we do that? Well, through naval trade. And that means that the United States should, I think, continue to be the predominant naval power in the world.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, when we talk about standing armies, like what do you define as a standing army, and what sort of military position would you put us in?
Well, a standing army is an army that you keep in peacetime in case something comes up. And this idea comes from English history. The English tradition was to maintain only a bare bones force in peacetime, and then when a war began, to rely on England's navy as its first line of defense, England being in a situation analogous to ours, in which it was an island nation, and then raise an army to fight the war, which almost invariably the English would win. And then as soon as the war ended, they would send the soldiers home. So people had temporarily higher taxes in wartime, and would see the tax burden pared back when the soldiers were sent home. That I think is a model we should want to emulate. Now, of course, what I'm actually have called for repeatedly is a complete reassessment of our military commitments, which I think are mostly based on inertia, not on any contemporary evaluation of their utility. I'm not saying that we wouldn't end up with a significant army, but it certainly would be nothing like the size of the army we have now. So
here's my next question, and this is the real question I think that we have to debate. How do we combat real threats of terrorism abroad without losing our liberties here at home? That's a big one.
Well, I'm just thinking about how the phrase combat real threats of terrorism abroad.
Like actual threats, like sincere intelligence. That comes from our agencies, that we know that, you know, if, for example, ISIS were to propose an actual credible threat to American, you know, interests overseas or domestically, I mean, how can we actually combat that while maintaining our liberties here at home, while not sacrificing our principles?
Well, I'm not sure in which sense you think this involves sacrificing our principles.
The warrantless wiretapping is something that some neoconservatives say. This is something where we have to sacrifice liberty for safety. You know, how can we possibly combat terrorism, 21st century terrorism, using 21st century techniques without violating the Fourth Amendment, for example?
Well, of course, the Fourth Amendment refers to reasonable search and seizure. So there's a lot of wiggle room there for the government when it comes to trying to persuade a judge that what it proposes to do is reasonable. It's not a blanket ban on searches or seizures. But in any event, my own feeling is that there needs to be substantial surveillance of overseas actors we think are involved in attempts or in planning of attacks on the United States. I also don't think that the American Constitution's guarantees, certainly the Fourth Amendment's guarantees, have anything to do with foreigners living abroad. So as far as I'm concerned, tapping Angela Merkel's phone was perfectly – in fact, I would expect our government to be tapping Angela Merkel's phone.
See, yeah, no kidding. But this was the kind of thing that outraged libertarians and saw them lionizing Edward Snowden because of his release of this information. But to me, I mean, they're all spying on us, so why can't we do it back? My problem is with the government spying on American citizens, really. But again, that makes me a bit of a nationalist rather than the sort of hardcore philosophical, I guess, anarchist, perhaps. But I guess I feel as if there's a bit of a large strain of naivete that runs through our movement, Professor, and I wonder if you see it as well.
Well, I do think that it is naive to think that you can have a society without a government. I mean, you know, how did that work for Tibet? I mean,
why don't you move to Somalia?
Right, well, I'm kidding. That's the standard riposte, of course, but again, I don't have any compunction about spying on foreigners. I think the U.S. government should do everything it can to be familiar with communications among leaders in China and Russia and in Germany. Mm-hmm. So that didn't bother me even one bit. The one thing that actually did bother me was that our government never said, well, you know, you're doing it to us too. This is not surprising.
Right.
They acted as if they had been caught with their hands in the cookie jar, and surely foreigners were all thinking, why do you pretend that this is not just routine?
Right.
So I do make this distinction between surveillance of foreigners and domestic surveillance. And beyond that, I think if you want to keep tabs on people in the United States who have regular communication with suspected hostile people abroad, then you should have to persuade a judge that that's reasonable. That's what the Fourth Amendment guarantees the executive has to do. So probably on that score, I am, you know, to the left of Jeb Bush, who's announced that he thinks the entire NSA program initiated by his brother was perfectly valid and should continue. I read that today, actually.
Yeah, I saw that. Now, here's a question for you. Are there any other cases in American history that we can look at in order to further our understanding of how to deal with these types of conflicts?
You mean besides the Barbary Pirates?
Yes.
There hasn't been a lot of examples of foreigners attacking American military assets since the Barbary episode. You know, there was a famous...
It really is sort of a new style of warfare that we're fighting. There really isn't a lot of precedent, is there?
No, there's not. There was a rather humiliating episode during the Ford administration involving the North Korean seizure of an American ship. My own feeling is that the U.S. government didn't respond forcefully enough. I mean, I would take the British of pre-World War II days as our model here. When a foreign country picks on an American civilian or certainly an American military asset, if foreigners seize an American embassy, there should be immediate and overwhelming havoc wrought upon them. But this is, of course, not the way that President Obama responded to recent events involving our embassy in Yemen, or the way that President Carter responded to events in Tehran. It's to my mind, it's somewhat disturbing that they allow these things to go unpunished.
Interesting. Would you consider yourself a non-interventionist, Professor?
Well, I'd have to have a definition. In general, that's my impulse.
Right.
But I do think that, again, every situation in international affairs is its own animal, and so I suppose I'm more prone to accept intervention. Well, more prone than Congressman Paul, and maybe about as prone as Senator Paul.
Very interesting. Well, that does make us a bit of enemies of some of the more hardcore black and white thinkers of this movement. Who it's, you know, you're either all or nothing. You're either an anarchist or you're a neocon, really. So it's
right.
Not an easy place to be in, Professor. But I sincerely appreciate your insight on this. Again, I'm a big fan of your books, and LibertyClassroom.com is where people can go to learn more. Can you tell us a little bit about Liberty Classroom, by the way?
Sure. Well, Tom Woods, Brian McClanahan, and I are among the faculty members there. And what LibertyClassroom.com is essentially is a a place where you can go to learn the history and economics they didn't teach you in school. So if you want to get a Jeffersonian perspective on American and European history, or an Austrian take on economics, take a look at libertyclassroom.com. It has available courses on numerous of the chief subjects that are of interest to libertarians, such as Austrian economics, constitutional history, intellectual history from the point of view of freedom-minded people. Not only courses, but there are regular chat sessions with the faculty members. There are forums where you can post questions at any time, and it's, I think, a great resource.
Fantastic, fantastic. Professor, thank you for your time.
I was happy to do it.